All right. I'm Amanda Knoll with the University of Florida, the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program. It's July 1st, 2010, and I'm here with...
My name is John Schmidt.
Great.
The full name is John E. Schmidt, Jr.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for agreeing to talk to us today, and I'd just like to start off with... maybe your early life. Tell us a little bit about your family and where you grew up, and then get into how you came to the Panama Zone.
Well, Amanda, I suppose that my reason for being here today, obviously, is because I had some connection to Panama and the Panama Canal. It wasn't but not too many years ago that in looking at my father's diary, of many, many years ago, he made an entry in 1928, and the entry was simply, "I plan to go to Panama." Now, I didn't know about this entry when my pop was alive, but my sister, who had the diary, made a copy of that page, and I never had really any idea why he wrote that in 1928. Other than when he was a young man in 1928, that would have made him being 25, he lived in Baltimore, Maryland, where he was born, and he shipped out on an oiler, a tanker, and the tanker eventually ended up in France and then back in Baltimore, and I don't know how many days that was, but I do have a record of the ship voyage when he left Baltimore, and he was signed on as a deckhand. It's very possible, now that I think back, that something happened on that voyage that made him think that Panama would be a good place to go to. 1928, he was 25, and I believe he was married shortly after that. I can't remember the dates now, but to shorten up the story, he went to Panama in 1934. So 34, 28, that's 6 years that he didn't go. And for whatever reason, I don't know. But he went to Panama in 1934 to work for the U.S. Army Signal Corps in the Canal Zone. Well, my mother and my sister and I, who in 1934 was just 3 years old, were living in Baltimore. And so in August of 1935, we, my sister, my mother, and I, arrived in the Panama Canal. And although I don't have any specific memories of that particular day or the fact that I was not quite 4 years old, but I do know we moved to a army post called Corozal on the Pacific side, and my father being working for the army, evidently they gave him a house to live in. I think it was obviously temporary because the house was really nothing more than an old paint shack. But I can remember it very well, being right in the middle of an army post with barracks all around. And I have a photograph of that building, and it truly was just a little square paint shack. And I have a picture of me standing in front of it in an army uniform. You couldn't tell it's army, but it was a khaki uniform. Mm-hmm. So that was the army's uniform. And I had little second lieutenant bars on my shoulder. Well, I was 4 years old, and I suppose that might have had some connection to my future, because I spent my adult life in the military, so mm-hmm. there must have been some connection there. Well, that was 1935, and I remember that we lived in several houses, apartments, for a couple of years. I don't have the dates down specifically, but I do remember one place we lived in Balboa was a 24-family house, a 24-family. You know, you think about that, they were actually apartments. Mm-hmm. But a lot of houses in the Panama Canal Zone were either single units, duplexes, four-family house, 12-family house. This was a 24-family house. And I remember that we families shared a bathroom, and I remember that was probably three, four, or half a dozen families shared one bathroom. So it wasn't very convenient. I do remember that. But I remember the fact that it was a family place to live. Mm-hmm. We soon moved to Peter McGill. Peter McGill was a lock town because that's where the Peter McGill locks were, and you probably heard that. But it's it was a small town, probably not more than three blocks long. If you look at this main road that goes in front of the town, and if you look at the map, there's probably only three blocks in that whole town that goes around in kind of a little circle around the Peter McGill Lake, and the locks being right all across the road. Well, my father worked for the Peter McGill locks, then he worked for the Panama Canal Company. And I remember moving there, and I think I was just, I can remember five years old, maybe 6 years old, but that is my best memories of being a young boy in the Panama Canal, living in the town of Peter McGill. The friends I made there are friends today, here with me today. In just a few moments, I'll be meeting with a group of those same people that I grew up with back in the early 1930s in the Canal Zone. Peter McGill was being a lock town during the war, was extremely active with the military. We had barrage balloons all over the town because it was protecting the locks. Mm-hmm. We had anti-aircraft positions on the hills around the town because they were protecting the locks. There were smudge pots, which were nothing more than smoke pots. I suppose they're similar to what is used in orange groves to protect in the wintertime to protect the fruit. I don't know where I got that from, but anyway, the smudge pots were used to set off smoke screens around the canal, the locks. And in those days, long before we had any other new modern technology, that was considered adequate to hide by smoke. Mm-hmm. Well, when the smudge pots were set off around the locks, around our town, it was not the most happiest times for the ladies. My mother, I remember rushing out to get the clothes off the clothesline because the smudge pots would leave soot all over the clothes that were hanging up. But the kids, we never thought about that. We thought it was fun, and we liked to run behind the truck and hide in the smoke and play. And, of course, when you think back now, certainly it wasn't healthy to be running and breathing all that burning oil, whatever it was really. So it was exciting as a little kid, being just 10 years old when the war started. And it was exciting to look and see the ships coming through the canal, the all the soldiers and all the activity around the locks with the military. I became what is known as a mascot. Mm-hmm. Now, a mascot at Florida State University, of course, is our beautiful horse. I can't think of the horse name right now, but Renegade. Mm-hmm. And Renegade is a mascot with FSU, and of course the Gators are mascot over at Florida, University of Florida. But I was a mascot with the Army Aircraft Anti-Aircraft Unit. Mm-hmm. And because close to where I lived in the town of Paraiso was the headquarters for this anti-aircraft unit. And the 906 AAA Battalion, I remember it very, very plainly. They had a patch made, which I still have, and I used to wear that on my shirt, which was my uniform. And during the days, I would help out at the unit by either working maybe in the dining hall, the mess hall they called it, or helping out on payday when the soldiers came through to get their pay, and I'd sit there with the first sergeant while he handed out the got the people to sign the roster, and the captain would hand out the money. I had little jobs to do around It was exciting, and being part of this anti-aircraft unit. That was 1943, and it was 1978 that I decided to try to contact somebody from that outfit. And I remembered the names, because I had them written down in some program or something, and so I found this same name in California, and I called, and it was the same person that was the commander of the headquarters battery, and we talked, and he was very surprised that I remembered and I could find him, especially. Of course, he was quite old, but he and his wife were on the phone, and they were thrilled to death that someone, some little kid from way back in 1943 would remember him. But it was fun. I enjoyed my life in the Panama Canal. It, of course, as everybody who basically grew up there, were born and raised there, their whole life was shaped by what we saw and what we learned and how we lived, and the fact that even today, 60, 70 plus years ago, we still know each other, see each other, stay in contact with each other. Extremely cohesive group of people. For me, it was my future life. Having grown up there and watching the military grow, watching the Air Force up in the interior of Panama at the air bases, Chamay Field and Riohana, and sitting on the sides of the field as a little kid and watching these airplanes take off and land, and the exercises and the training that they did, never thinking about it then, but it shaped my life because I joined the Air Force after graduating from high school in 1950, and then I spent the next 30 years on active duty with the Air Force. So when I think back of how I became to be what I am today, I think it had to do with what you were when. You know, I was there, and what you were when is a takeoff on you are what you were when. In other words, in 1940s, that's the way life was, and that's part of the way my personality is shaped. And I am very proud of it and very extremely pleased to know that I grew up there and the friends that I made. I married there. I married the daughter of the superintendent of Gorgas Hospital, Colonel Blitch, and had children born there. And so even though they didn't have the long tenure that I did living there, they're very proud to think that they were born in the Panama Canal. I went back again after, in my service life, 20 years after I had left, on my first assignment, because I enlisted there in 1951. Mm-hmm. And in 1973, I went back for another tour duty back at Albrook Air Force Base. And after being away 20 years, it was great to be home again. And I enjoyed my tour. And since then, I've been back four or five times on trips, either on a cruise or on a flight. Mm-hmm. And I always look forward to going back, although it is nothing like it was when I was growing up. We always remember that even though the lake that was behind my house, not more than 30, 50 feet away from my house when I was a little boy, to me looked like a massive lake. And it actually was really, really quite small. But when you're small, things look big. And when you're older, they look much smaller. So when I go back in recent trips, where I live is no longer there. Houses are gone, replaced by other houses. Streets have been renamed. The place is very familiar because you don't forget some things, but it saddens into a certain way when it's no longer the Panama Canal Zone. it's Republic of Panama. Be that as it may, it's still fun to go back. It's always a pleasure to remember growing up in the Panama Canal, because it was just such a close-knit group of people. With only two high schools and one junior college, you know, there's just a remembrance and a appreciation of friends that you just take with you. All of my schooling took place in the Canal Zone, and that also is another thing that it's worth saying, is that the people who went to the Panama Canal schools were far and ahead of most other high schools in the United States, or schools, in advance in the knowledge that they got from those schools. In fact, when kids would come down from the States to the Canal Zone to go to school for the first time, like maybe grade school or junior high school, they usually had to go back a year because they were not quite up to speed with the rest of the levels in the Canal Zone schools. So I'm very proud of that. And I can only say, as although the memories are extensive, and I've only covered just a few things in the 25 years that I lived there, I believe I am today a very lucky person to have grown and lived in the Panama Canal. My friends that I made are still with me in the majority of cases, and my family has a major connection to the canal, and so I continue to think that when someone says, "Where are you from?" I might have been born in Baltimore, Maryland, but I always say I'm from Panama, the Panama Canal Zone.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your parents? Did they retire in the Panama Canal Zone?
My friends?
Your parents?
My parents. Pop unfortunately had a little medical problem in about 1966, and he had to retire, medically retire. So Mom and Dad left Panama and came back and settled in Maryland, basically where they both were born. Mm-hmm. But leaving behind my sister and my brother. My sister was working for the Inter-American Geodetic Survey. My brother was working for the Panama Canal Company. And they both married there and stayed there for a number of years later. My sister probably left, I think she did, in 73 with her husband and child. And two children, and they retired in Kerrville, Texas, where they currently live. Now, my younger brother, Douglas, he married, and I cannot remember the exact year, but he married a local girl. Mm-hmm. Actually, Sharon Booth was her maiden name. She's a fourth-generation Zonian. Wow. Fourth generation. That's how many grandparents were involved and parents were involved in the construction of the canal. Now, Doug, my younger brother, was born there at Ancon in 1936, and so he stayed there until he retired from the Panama Canal Company. So he was probably there for a total of like 59 years after he retired. And he also lives in Kerrville, Texas. Mom and Dad are both gone, but you can walk into my house or my sister's house or my brother's house, and you immediately know that there's some connection to the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about your school experience? Maybe did you play sports or anything like that?
You know, I was not much into sports, mm-hmm. primarily because before I got into high school, I had twice hit my head in play enough to give me a brain concussion. Minor, but enough for the doctors to say it's not advisable to get into contact sports. Mm-hmm. So my involvement with sports at high school level was in the school student managers type work, and, you know, helping the team, working with the team. Although I didn't play football or basketball, I was the student manager for both of the varsity teams. And that was kind of neat, even though I didn't play. I got to share in some of the glory of the teams, and it led me to being allowed to be inducted into what they call the Letterman's Club because I was part of the varsity team, carrying the water bucket or whatever it was, but I was still part of the team. Now, my activity in sports at, in a younger time frame, when I was 10 in that area, was swimming. And Peter McGill, as in all of the towns, we had our own pools. And so that was a major activity, was swimming. And so when I was young, 10, 11, 12, I was really active in the swimming teams of those towns. That didn't carry on into high school. I was active in high school in music. I played in the band and in the orchestra. Probably my most active part in high school was with the junior ROTC program. Mm-hmm. In high school, at Balboa High School, the ROTC, Army ROTC, came to the Canal Zone schools in 1948. And so I was in the first class of the junior ROTC program, and I was a junior at the time. So the way they start the junior programs is those students who are seniors will be the cadet officers, and those students who are juniors would be the cadet NCOs, the sergeants. So I was a junior, so therefore I was a cadet sergeant. In fact, I was a cadet master sergeant. And this is an interesting thing, and I'm glad you asked this question because it's really worth, I tell my grandchildren about it. When I was a cadet master sergeant and as a junior in high school, I let my grades slip. And they went to the point where the ROTC said if you didn't have a certain grade point average, you couldn't hold a cadet rank. And so they took my master sergeant stripes away. Well, people might think that, geez, that's no big deal. That was just high school. But it was a big deal. The fact that they demoted me because my grades weren't good enough, it made a major change in my academic thinking. And so the next 6 weeks, I got my grades back and I got my rank back. And from then on, and this was the early part of my junior year until my graduation in June of 1950, my grades were high enough that I made the B honor rolls 4 or 5 times. In never before in my school's years did I ever do that well. Mm-hmm. It was all because I wasn't going to let that happen to me again, mm-hmm. regarding my grades being inferior. So when I started my senior year in 1949, I was promoted to the rank of cadet lieutenant colonel, which was the head ranking cadet officer for the cadet corps. And for my year, for the remainder of the school year, I was the cadet battalion commander, and that was a significant honor, as well as a magnificent incentive to maintain good grades. And I'm really proud of that. My grandchildren, it was a story I tell them because, you know, think about it. You know, it's like when you take away something you really like, not only is it embarrassing in front of your student, your peers, but it's also something to think about. You know, is that what I want in life? And so 1950, when I graduated as a ranking cadet, it wasn't too much to decide what I wanted to do with my life. And so therefore, when I enlisted in the Air Force just less than a year later, it was, I guess, preordained that that's what I was going to do.
Yep. Did you and your family travel at all when you were younger?
You know, traveling was something that, the only traveling that we did was back and forth from the Canal Zone to the States. Uh-huh. We got there in 1935, I feel certain that we made a trip in 1936. I know we made a trip in 1938 because I've got the ship's manifest showing that our family traveled back to New York. Uh-huh. And, of course, that was the days you went from the Canal Zone to Haiti, and you stopped in Port-au-Prince for a half a day, mm-hmm. and then you continued on to New York. Mm-hmm. And then from New York, what we would do would take a train down to Baltimore, which is where we spent our vacation, usually a good 2 or 3 months anyway. And I think we did that, I know we did it three times. I never traveled, and Mom and Dad were not of the traveling type, out of Panama other than going back to the States. Mm-hmm. Now, everything we did was there or back to New York and then just for summer vacation.
Mm-hmm. How was returning back to the States? Was it difficult at all? Was it exciting?
To go back to the States? Well, it was kind of interesting and exciting because having been raised, I wasn't born there now, but, you know, going there when I was not quite four, that's almost being raised. I mean, that's almost living there your whole life. Mm-hmm. It was exciting to get back to the States because primarily for the change of weather, even though it was during the summertime that we would go at school summertime, school vacation. It was always exciting because, first of all, I liked the boat trip. The boat trips were always a lot of fun for me. My mother, of course, was not at all happy. She was very, very sick on the boat. But, I was young enough that I didn't think too much about it. But mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. And getting to the States, seeing my relatives in Baltimore was always exciting. And that was the only connection we had. My father had 7 sisters and brother. And lots of cousins. In fact, 21 first cousins lived, and some still there in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Traveling on the boat was a lot of fun. And I don't remember what year it was, and I was by myself. So I think it must have been coming back from the States, New York to Panama. And I have a feeling that it was probably 1950, because when I graduated from high school, I decided that I was going to go to the States and make a living in Baltimore working for my uncle, who was an electrical contractor. And I left Canal Zone in June of 1950 and traveled to New York on a school boat. Lots of my friends. It was a wonderful trip because all my classmates are there. Mm-hmm. Those that were had just graduated, we're going to go to the States and continue in college. Mm-hmm. And I was going to go make a life for myself in Baltimore. Well, in June, it probably wasn't in a couple of weeks later that I decided I'd made a mistake, that I didn't want to live there. And I really, really wanted to go back home. Uh-huh. And so I called my pop and I said what I want to do. And he said, well, I'll send you a ticket and get you on the next boat. Mm-hmm. So in August of 1950, just a couple months after I left, I boarded a ship in New York to come back to Panama. Well, this has to be the trip because I've tried to determine, and no one else can remember, but the ship's nurse died. And when she died, evidently she had left in her will that she wanted to be buried at sea. Mm-hmm. And I remember it distinctly, the fact that she died, that was notified right away, and that the ship would stop, and a burial service would take place with the nurse, and I can't remember her name. And I remember all of us going to the side of the ship for the service. The ship was dead in the water, and they buried her at sea, and then we took off again. And that had to have been August of 1950. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that if I could find somebody from the Panama Railroad Company who had involvement with the ship, that they could precisely date that and give me the name. That's the traveling that we did, and I remember that particular trip.
So that summer in 1950, what made you decide that it wasn't the place for you to live?
It's probably because I just was not happy enough in Baltimore, and not comfortable enough working and starting off a whole new life in very strange surroundings. And maybe it was that I just wasn't ready to leave home. You know, I was in 1950, I was 19. You know, and that should be old enough. God knows it's old enough for people to be at war and get killed and so forth. But I wasn't ready to leave home. And so I wanted to go back to Panama. I wanted to go back to the Canal Zone. And I did. And I immediately went to work for the Panama Canal's Navigation Department. And I was going to learn how to be a signalman out at the Flamenco Island, where they would signal the ships as they come towards the canal. And I think I worked out there for about 3 or 4 months and realized that I could get a better job. And I went to work for the Navy on the west bank of the canal at Rodman Naval Station. Went to work for the Navy in a refrigeration shop. And that was a good job. I was learning a good trade. And then a friend of mine who I had grown up with in the Canal Zone, Jack Budrow, and we had known each other for many years, he came back and he came out to my house and he said, I'm going to join the Air Force. Why don't you come with me? And I said, well, I'm working. He said, yeah, but you can quit. I said, okay. And so we did. I quit my job at the Navy and went across the canal at Albrook Air Force Base on 27th of April, 1951, raised my hand and became a United States Air Force Airman. And so going back home was predestined, preordained, and then I started my career in the Air Force. I can't think of a day, can't think of a time that I can recall that was regretful. It was a wonderful life, and I don't think there's too many people that can disagree with that.
Did your siblings, they stayed in the Panama Zone as well?
Who?
Your siblings?
Well, my brother and sister stayed there just until they retired. I think Jackie left in 73 when her husband retired from the Panama Company, and Doug stayed until, I think it was 90. It could have been 89, or he was there doing just cause, and I believe it was shortly thereafter that he decided to retire, and so he retired to the States. So I have no connections there at all, and of course nobody lives there than the family, but I still have, well, as I said, it's the greatest of memories and the fondest of times in my life.
Can you talk a little bit about the culture growing up? Would you say that it was a pure American culture? Was there some mixture there?
Well, that's an interesting thing because where I lived in the town of Peter McGill, Peter McGill was right next to a local rate. That's an expression, local rate, meant the people who were Panamanian, people, Panamanian citizens, they weren't American citizens, they weren't white, they were black, they were Jamaican, mestizos. The town was called Red Tank. Red Tank was right up against the town of Peter McGill. It was only separated by just a few hundred feet. And actually, there was no gates, no nothing. But Red Tank people lived in a town by themselves, but they came through our town either walking to work at the locks or walking to work into the town where I lived at a different thing. I don't ever remember there ever being any animosities whatsoever to anybody in some other race or some other ethnic group. The only thing I can remember is being a little concerned for my safety when I would go into the Republic of Panama. And by that I mean they were not necessarily always the friendliest towards the gringos. And so when I was younger and probably a little bit more concerned about my safety, I would feel a little apprehensive if I was going to a movie downtown in Panama, which of course was nothing more than walking across the streets from the Canal Zone into the Republic. Once again, there was no gates, there was no fences or anything. I sometimes had a little feeling of concern for my safety. Mm-hmm. I did not have this when I went to the interior of Panama. Mm-hmm. When I was in the interior, in Santa Clara, in Gorgona, in Los, in El Valle, and all the towns up into the interior, never was there any concern for that, because these were just a whole different kinds of people. They may have been Panamanians. They may have been other than white. Mm-hmm. And they were more country folks. They were just great people. Mm-hmm. And they were friendly and invite you in the house and be more friendly. The only time I had any concern for major concern was in November of when the Panama Republic of Panama had their elections. Mm-hmm. And whenever they had an election, it was always a very difficult time. Mm-hmm. Because they were a little bit out of control. Mm-hmm. I loved the Panamanian culture, mostly in the interior. Mm-hmm. In the cities, it was not very clean and not as friendly.
Mm-hmm. In school and at the at your house, was there any Spanish speaking going on?
Of course, in the school, Spanish was one of the major classes. Okay. I took Spanish for a couple of years, but I was not too good a student at that time, and so I didn't learn. But what I learned in the way of speaking Spanish and the language was just living there. Uh-huh. It was kind of when you're immersed into it, it just becomes part of your nature. Even today, I'm always honing my Spanish. Even though I can't start talking to somebody in Spanish, uh-huh. I can understand and comprehend what's going on mm-hmm. by listening to certain words and phrases. We had a Panamanian lady as a maid. Uh-huh. We never had anything other than someone who would come and come and clean the house. That's uh-huh. all. We never had a cook like some people did. We did have somebody who would come and when I was growing up and would be help my mom in the house, but mm-hmm. And she spoke perfectly good English, as almost most people did. Spanish, I think, would have been wonderful had I been more conversant. Mm-hmm. Some of my classmates that I'm with today speak Spanish just like it was their, you know, primary language. Mm-hmm. Because they took more advantage of learning than I did. But when I see somebody speaking Spanish, I don't hesitate to, if it's okay, to participate so I can keep my Spanish sharpened up.
Did you experience any anti-American feelings when you were over there? Were you, did you experience any of the riots?
I don't recall anything truly anti-American. Mm-hmm. In fact, just the opposite. When I went back, when I left on a permanent basis, I left in 1976 uh-huh. When I was assigned back to the United States. And coincidentally, I was assigned to Panama City, Florida, which is... I was coming from Panama City, Panama, to Panama City, Florida, and that's where I retired from active duty. But mm-hmm. when I went back again, it was 1999, and I went back, and I remember in the Hotel El Panama, mm-hmm. which was a large, very large hotel. In fact, it was a hotel that when I was married in 1953 is where my wife and I spent our honeymoon in that hotel. Mm-hmm. So in 1999, I remember going back to the hotel. And, of course, things were just about to turn over from the United States to Panama mm-hmm. in the year 2000. And in 1999, it was June, and there was only 6 months left of the American connection. Mm-hmm. And then it was going to disappear. And I can remember distinctly people in the hotel saying how sorry they were and how fretful they were that the U.S. connection was going to be gone mm-hmm. forever. Now, obviously, these were people in the service industry, and they recognized the American dollar. Mm-hmm. as anybody would, and here, if an Air Force base was going to close in Biloxi, Mississippi, wow, that would be disastrous for the community because of the money. I think the Panama people may have thought that the same. But you know what? I don't ever remember having any nationalist feeling of hate, ever. I mentioned a few minutes ago that I did have some concern for my safety, and that may have been because their hot-headed nature of the Panamanian police, as an example, and especially towards the military, that was not good. But no, I never experienced anything personally. In fact, it was just the opposite most of the time.
Can you explain your feelings about the Operation Just Cause?
I think Just Cause, of course, was a definite requirement. There's a point in time when the America and the United States has to stand up and say no, and stand up and put your foot down and stop something that's ongoing, that's not right. I was very concerned on the 20th of December when this took place, and I can remember my brother called me from Panama, and it was close to midnight, and I remember him saying, I don't know what's going on, but something is happening. There's gunfire all over the place. And he said, I'm really concerned because Cheryl, that was his daughter, is coming back from the States. And she was arriving that night, coincidentally, from Miami on a flight. And he says, I'm really concerned because I have to go out to the airport to pick up Cheryl. And I have to say that my major concern was for the safety of my brother, his wife, and his child. I had no other family there at the time. And so once Cheryl was arrived safely, and once she and my brother were home, back home in the canal zone safely, I was relieved and then sort of excited because 1989, I had, of course, been in the service for quite a while, and I had spent a year in Saigon during the height of the war. And so I was a little bit interested in my brother, here he was, a civilian, in a combat zone. And not only in a combat zone, but in my old town and in my old high school. And so I think it was a very justified just cause to do what they did to bring down the corruption. Unfortunately, people die in combat, and innocent people die in combat. But I think it was necessary to do. It was also an exceptionally... well, I don't know if that's what I was going to say. It was a way to hone the efficiency and proficiency of military technology as well. We learned a lot in that war. We learned a lot that has to do with communication between groups of people that we found were not working good and certainly have been corrected. As to the cause and the reasons for it, I think we did the right thing.
Can you talk about maybe your feelings about the U.S. turnover in general, how you think the future of Panama is looking in the canal?
You know, when I lived there, and I can remember very clearly my father's helper. You know, when you're a mechanic and when you're a tradesman, and you're not sitting in an office, but you're working on telephones or working on cable splicing or working at the machine shop. Those are crafts. And all the Americans had a helper. And those helpers were Panamanians. And I remember my father's helper was named Caballero. Caballero, which means gentleman. Caballero. Yes, means gentleman. And Caballero was my father's helper. And I can remember watching Dad work and working with his helper and how incredibly Caballero depended on my father to tell him what to do. He couldn't necessarily do it himself on his own initiative. But when he, I can remember my father asking for something and he wouldn't know what to do. He just had to be told. Mm-hmm. So I guess that it was somewhat ingrained in my thinking, and there's a lot of people that live there. So when we left, when the Americans left, and when the United States gave away everything that was American, and I truly mean gave away, that's my major objection to the fact that the canal was given away. They didn't pay one penny for anything. I thought, as a lot of people, the Panamanians and the Republic of Panama would not be able to run the canal. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, I didn't think they'd have the competency to do it. Mm-hmm. Because I watched them build buildings. I watched them build apartment complexes and hotels. And over the years, I would see those hotels and buildings start to fall down because they never maintained them. Mm-hmm. And they never took care of them until they fell down. Then they just let it fall down. So I thought, along with a lot of other people, that they're never, ever going to be able to run the Panama Canal locks. I'm wrong. I'm the first to admit it, and I have no hesitation to admit it. I was wrong. They're doing a good job. Now, they may not necessarily count things the way we do. Mm-hmm. They may not necessarily have a counting system that is equal to ours, but the example is that they may say that we have fewer accidents than the Americans did. They may say, oh yeah, we're doing so good because we don't have many accidents. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about ship accidents in the canal. Well, and they may say that, but it's because, yes, they may have had the same amount of accidents, but they call them differently. Mm-hmm. They have a category that's not the same as the Americans. And so therefore, if we had a ship hit the locks, that would be an accident. Mm-hmm. Or run into the wall, that would be an accident. But maybe Panama doesn't count that as an accident. Maybe they have to wait till they do it three times before. And so therefore, they have less numbers. Mm-hmm. I think they're doing a great job, but there may be some things that maybe not equally accounted. Mm-hmm. Because we call it different than what they called it. Mm-hmm. I am in contact even today with the people who are running the Panama Canal Authority. I have, ever since I have been in the military especially, I've always been an advocate of the Panama Canal and the operation of the locks. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, when my brother was there in a position of responsibility and authority, he would provide me with the current information about the operation, and I would use it in my speeches that I gave in the military, at the Air Force Academy. I was called upon a number of times to speak to professors on the operation of the Panama Canal. And I continually do that. Even today, here in 2010, I'm still giving briefings on the Panama Canal. So as recently as 2 weeks ago, I received the most current version of the PowerPoint presentation on the expansion of the Panama Canal. I have it with me now, and I intend to show it to my classmates during our reunion here. Mm-hmm. Our classmates are having our 60th reunion from Balboa. So I have current information that I'm going to pass on. And people ask me, even today, that I know and know me, questions about the canal because I continue to maintain currency in what's uh-huh. going on. Uh-huh. So when I say they're doing a good job, I really believe I'm saying that from some sort of honesty and mm-hmm. some sort of forthrightness, because I see what's going on and I think they're doing a good job. And I haven't found anybody who will tell me differently. They think they're doing a good job too.
What do you think draws you to keep that connection with the Panama Canal?
You know, that's also a question that I've often thought about. And I have to go back that you are what you were when. And I think my whole life was shaped by the fact that I was raised in that kind of wonderful environment of the significant engineering feat of history. The Americans who built the canal, who engineered it, who felt the way to go was the way it ended up. We're able to take early concepts of construction and turn it into such a marvelous engineering feat. Now, I'm not an engineer. I have nothing even close to that kind of academic background. But to think what they had to do to build the Panama Canal in 1914 when it opened, and it's just always been so ingrained in my pride that even today I feel it's important. And so just, I don't recall when it was, but within the last week or so, someone said something that had to do with water or something, and I mentioned about the canal and its association with water. And, well, the conversation ended up with talking about the Panama Canal. And you know, so many people, a few moments ago I mentioned that I used to talk to the engineers at the Air Force Academy. In the Department of Mechanical Engineering, it was amazing how many of those full colonels and those officers really did not have a full understanding of how the canal worked. Mm-hmm. And I just reveled in the fact that I could tell them how it worked. It's amazing. The construction that's going on now that the Panama Canal Authority says will be completed by 2014, it will be, I hope my life lasts long enough to see this happen, because it's going to be amazing what they are going to do. And they're going to do it without the help of the United States. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, we're not there, and we're not involved in this expansion. So what they're going to do is proof. When I say they're doing a good job, I think it's proof because they're making a new canal.
Yeah. Do you think this legacy of pride over the canal has continued into further generations, like with your grandchildren that you've mentioned?
You really have some soul-searching questions because, and you see, even though I have two children born there, but they were so young when they left, they don't have the connection that I do. And even though I have everything in my house that reflects my youth, and my connection to the canal, I don't find any of my grandkids really excited about that. Maybe the oldest, who is just now entered the academy at FBI up in Quantico, Virginia. He just recently, this past month, became a student at the academy. He has an interest. An interest to ask questions, and when he sees things, he'll ask for clarification and things about the canal. But I was teaching Air Force ROTC for 15 years after I retired from the Air Force. And so where I was teaching in high school, I would ask questions like, do you know where the Panama Canal is? And it was shameful, the number of students that didn't have the background in education, these were freshmen, to tell me where the Panama Canal was. They had no idea where it was. And then I always like to stretch their mind by having them think. I would say, show a map of the Isthmus of Panama and show them how in the morning you could see the sun coming up in the Pacific Ocean. And setting in the Atlantic Ocean. Now, if you lived in the canal zone, and in the morning when the sun came up out of the east, the way the shape of the Isthmus of Panama is, it would actually be coming up in what you consider to be the Pacific Ocean, because that's where you live next to. And it's set over on the other side, which would be the Atlantic side. The Atlantic has to be east. So, I mean, you think that way. And I would ask these cadets, and 99% had no idea what the answers were. They couldn't follow it. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think that has a thing to do with maybe there's a lack of interest in the Panama Canal. I think it has to do with a lack of education mm-hmm. that's been provided to our children over the recent years, mm-hmm. and why we're so far behind in math, science, and engineering mm-hmm. things. So it's scary. So as to whether there might be a continuing interest in the Panama Canal, I'm not happy about that. I don't think there is.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add? Maybe one more happy memory about the canal?
I'm trying to come to that. And I honestly can't put my finger on one thing other than the fact that my youth, and I have to say this would be from the age of 8 to about 15, 16, mm-hmm. had to have been the most exciting time of my life. Thinking back of where I lived and the fact that everything was so open and free and so unencumbered with thoughts or concerns about of your life being in danger, knowing that you could leave your house and walk to school and then stop by the clubhouse and have a milkshake on, or go to the clubhouse and go to the movies and walk up into the jungles and just a few blocks and spend a day at swimming holes go home and start to work on a kayak that I was making under my house. A lot of houses in those days were built on stilts, mm-hmm. and they were built on stilts to keep the, you know, animals and insects out of the house. Well, you know, and because the stilts were creosoted, so animals, birds, I mean the insects. The point when I say under the house is there was always an openness to mm-hmm. the house. And so I was building a kayak. My father helped me, and I remember covering it with canvas and painting the canvas a gray paint. And when the paint dried, it made the canvas waterproof. And so there we had this little kayak. It couldn't have been more than 8 feet long. And we would build our own and then go out on the lake. And so trying to put together a single moment of truly wonderful, happy memories, it has to be my life as a Canal Zone brat. Had to be a summation uh-huh. of what would be happy. I can truly be called a Canal Zone brat and have nothing but a smile on my face.
Well, that's certainly a happy thought to end yes. this interview yeah. with. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for meeting with us.
Well, thank you.
It's a great record
to have. I'm really happy to participate. I was asked to do this at FSU's mm-hmm. World War II Institute, mm-hmm. and it was a pleasure because when it was all done and when it was edited and cleaned up and copied, mm-hmm. I made copies for each of my 5 children, and therefore they had a record of their father's life as a young boy. So this will also
yes.
accommodate that.
Good luck.
Thank you. Good, good.